Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your go-to Newcastle United podcast brought to you by The Athletic. My name's Taylor Payne, and I'm joined, as always, by Chris Woff and George Culkin. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking to Zara Zamorodian all about her fantastic film, We Are the Geordies. We're going to look back at that Palace game, and also we're going to be talking a little bit about Alan Saint-Maximin and what's going on with him. But before we get into any of that, to celebrate Black Friday week, we're giving you the chance to subscribe to The Athletic for our best ever price. It's just £1 a month for a full 12 months, and you can cancel it any time. So you can access all of The Athletic all year long, including all of our podcasts, completely ad-free. We'll bring you unrivaled Newcastle coverage for an unbeatable price, and we won't be running a better deal anytime soon, so get stuck in. This offer is running until the 4th of December, so please don't miss out. Go to theathletic.com/Newcastle Pod and pay just £1 a month for 12 months. This offer is for new subscribers only. And now that I have our administrative work out of the way, good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm here with George and Chris. How's it going?
Good afternoon. Very well, thank you. And you?
I'm all right. Chris, how are you doing? You healthy?
I'm fine, thank you. Yes, it's good to hear from you too. I don't know what I said there. I sort of mixed my words, so I apologise.
It's good to hear from you.
I mean, it also can't have been much as you make it sound like a surprise that we've like rung you up and started talking to you, as opposed to this being something that's in your calendar every week.
I mean, it often feels like that, to be honest.
Yeah, I do. It feels like
a spur of the moment thing, isn't it? I think there's only one place we can start here, gents, and that is the news that has just broken that Newcastle's game against Aston Villa on Friday night has been postponed due to a COVID outbreak at the club. Chris, you're the one who's been the closest to all of this and what's going on. What's happened here?
Yeah, well, this has been an ever-developing story over the last, say, 48 hours, really, on Newcastle. As far as they're concerned, on Sunday there was additional tests to positive tests to the three that had already been recorded before Friday's trip to Crystal Palace, and they feared that more were going to follow, and so they had additional tests on Sunday. Yesterday the training ground was closed. The training ground has been closed today. Today is Tuesday, by the way. So the training ground was closed again today, and basically since Monday evening, really, it's looked close to inevitable that Newcastle were going to push for postponement. And there's been very quick developments during the course of today, where Newcastle have consulted with Public Health England. They've spoken to various different local authorities. They've also conversed with the Premier League and basically tried to find out if it was possible to postpone the match. I think it's not only the number of positive cases, although Newcastle have confirmed there's been a significant increase in positive cases without confirming how many exactly they've had, but also I think there was fears over travel down to how are they going to go to an away game, how are they going to, were they going to be able to stay overnight, how would they travel, the families of some players, their safety. And so really it's about a safety issue here, and so eventually I think the right decision has come around. There is a human element to this, and so eventually we've found out that Friday night's game, it's the first Premier League match to be postponed because of an outbreak of COVID-19.
It's absolutely the right decision, isn't it, George?
Categorically, yeah. I mean, I think there's a couple of things to say about it. I mean, the first thing is from all of us is that we hope everybody at Newcastle's all right, and those people who are suffering get well soon. And it's important to say that. The other thing is that it feels to me like a common sense decision. We've been sort of looking at those regulations over the past couple of days, and there was a very high bar for games to get postponed and called off. But you want kind of football to sort of acknowledge that, having been presented as this antidote almost to lockdown the first time around, that there was this duty for footballers to come back and entertain us whilst we were all stuck in the house. It's a reminder that footballers are not immune to this and that they're very much part of it. We have to remember that they're kind of putting their health on the line, not just through the normal stuff in football, but doing this as well, albeit they're tested a lot. And it's also kind of a great reminder to all of us as we do need to be careful, and this isn't going anywhere. It hasn't. And so, you know, we owe it to ourselves to be careful. But I'm pleased that this hasn't become a sort of big drawn out battle with the Premier League to get it called off. Newcastle made a point of thanking Villa for their understanding and cooperation, and yeah, thankfully that's happened.
I mean, I'm surprised that it's taken this long for something like this to happen, for there to be a major outbreak. But like we've heard again and again, the kind of health and safety of the players and the staff at the training grounds and stuff like that has been paramount where this is concerned. The social distancing that's been involved, all of the checks that have been done, the testing and all that sort of stuff, it's been put in and it's been implemented well. But I'm still surprised that it's taken this long for there to be a major outbreak. But Chris, from your point of view, what's the next steps now then? Is there a plan in place for Newcastle? Is there a plan of when this fixture might get replayed?
Well, the news has literally just broken in the last 15-20 minutes. I mean, Newcastle say within the statement that in due course they will find out and they will let us know when the fixture can be replayed. I'm not sure whether the fact that both clubs aren't in Europe means that they could fit it in somewhere in terms of when it's a Champions League night or a European night. I mean, immediately...
FA Cup fourth round weekend, I probably think it'll probably be the best time to do it.
I mean,
Villa might still be in, to be honest.
I would echo George's comments, and there is a human element to this which I think sometimes gets overlooked, that yes, there are players, their families involved here, staff members, and yeah, we really hope that they are all safe and well very soon and that this doesn't spread any further. But that's the main thing now, is that Newcastle need to contain the spread. They need to make sure that no more players and staff members become infected, that the training ground is a safe place again, and then start preparing for whenever the next game may be. Hopefully the West Brom game will be all right. I suppose that depends on how many players have tested positive, how long their isolation periods are. All of that is a little bit uncertain at the moment, but I think the health and safety had always had to be the priority. Newcastle United have always made sure it has been. And to be fair on Newcastle, I know that they receive a lot of criticism, rightly, in a lot of quarters, but I don't think this is anything to do with the potential provisions that they've had in place or otherwise. They have, from the start, have led with some of the protocols, for example, banning handshaking at the training ground, and their doctor is renowned in terms of, they've even created an app to make sure that people have been safe and that they're entering a secure environment. This has come about since the last national break. They're still trying to work out exactly what the source is, but this could in theory have happened anyway. I don't think this is just a Newcastle United problem. This could have happened to any club.
I'll be surprised if this is the last one as well. I'll be very surprised if there isn't another one of these sort of outbreaks somewhere else, in either in the Premier League or in another league. But like I say, it's a surprise that it's taken this long to happen. I thought, you know, I think the league and the clubs have handled this really well so far. I think you have to take your hat off to them for how well they've done with this virus, because it's pretty nasty once it gets into a group of people.
Yeah, I mean, it's been in my family, and obviously I've written about that. My stepdad got it and got it really badly and was in intensive care three times and came out three times, and we thought we'd lost him on a couple of occasions. And, you know, it's something that will live with us for the rest of, you know, forever, basically. And it's not a joke. And so, I mean, it's not good to have these reminders, but it's important that we get them sometimes. I mean, it is, as you say, it's become a far more sort of commonplace thing now, but it is just that, you know, just that reminder that, albeit the Northeast is going into sort of the highest, you know, tier of non-lockdown, or whatever we call it. But
yeah,
it is that reminder that we're not through it yet. Please wear your masks. Please take it easy. Please be careful. Please wash your hands. All those things. Footballers who do have these incredible strict protocols, and I'd echo exactly what Chris has said before. The doctor at Newcastle is has been on top of this from the start. They did do all that stuff very early. They have taken it very seriously. They do get tested all the time, and it's, you know, and it can still happen. So it's just it's that reminder that we just must be careful.
So what happens from here then, Chris? Newcastle United will have another fixture in the near future. And do you think they'll be the team will be ready? The club will be in a position where they're ready to play that next fixture?
Well, that's sort of an unanswerable question at the minute. It depends on that. There has been a fear that more positive tests could return. They're going to be tested again tomorrow, which is Wednesday, so there could be more positive tests. So that could throw further plans into disarray, really. I mean, for now, I think they're focusing on the safety of the players, and they can cross that next bridge when they come to it. And I think we'll probably have more of a clearer idea towards the end of the week. But certainly Friday's game just didn't seem realistic in any way, shape or form. There's another week or so after that before the West Brom game, so there's a bit more time, but I think just that the immediate concern is the safety, really.
Yeah, and obviously with isolation and quarantine and stuff like that, it's difficult to get an idea on how soon, how many players are actually going to be fit and healthy. And the other thing with this virus as well that a lot of people don't talk about is the lasting effects that go on after you've had the virus. I had it in August, and I'm still not completely right now. I still find myself gasping for breath. Part of that is because I'm a big fat knacker. Getting up and down the stairs is taking its toll on me as I get older. But the kind of layover effects from the virus itself are difficult, and you don't know how. I mean, obviously, footballers are a big, fit and healthy lads, and hopefully it'll not take its toll on them too much. But you just don't know what's going to come from this.
No, they're in the right demographic to get it, if you know what I mean. But there is, of course, the potential of there being a football sort of a lingering effect in terms of the football itself, because if the training ground is closed or if players can't come in for training, then obviously that has effect on the work they can do. That certainly isn't ideal, notwithstanding this game being called off. It's time away from the training pitch. It's time away from practicing the formation that they played against Crystal Palace this weekend. So it's not ideal in any way, shape or form. We can sort of all make jokes about being able to sort of sit back and relax and not have to worry about Newcastle this weekend, but there are serious points attached to it, and of course it's not good news.
At what point do we need to start looking at football on a whole and looking at the wider idea here that maybe it's not a good idea to be playing football at the minute in the middle of a pandemic, a global pandemic? Is it something that the conversations are happening anyway? I mean, is this going to be a wake-up call for the Premier League or anyone like that? I mean, could this have knock-on effects, Chris, do you think, going forward? Could there be a potential situation where football is stopped again?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that really, that if it becomes a situation where health and safety of players and staff and the wider public comes into question, then maybe it is something we have to think about. It's been several months and there haven't been too many problems. I suppose the issues have been is when there have been international breaks, when players have gone away and come back, there have been situations where that has tended to see certainly the Premier League cases increase slightly. So
I honestly don't know why we're playing international football at the minute. I don't understand.
I imagine there's a large financial element to it as the reason. I think that's the reason playing football in general, really, is for all the other connotations have been out there and the suggestions that this is because it's for the wider good of the public. I think this is all to do with finances. There's so many elements of life are, to be fair.
I'll just interrupt, Chris. I mean, I think the good thing about football coming back, and you know, we all have opinions about what football looks like and feels like now. And we'll talk about this in another discussion we've got coming up. But the one area where it's been very successful has been to kind of get through it and to kind of get through it relatively unscathed. The way that the game has been able to do that has been in shutting things down very, 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 very quickly and very, very closely. Now, I suppose the one wild card you've got from this situation is that Newcastle went to Palace last Friday, knowing that they had some cases around the place, and then those cases have sort of grown in the days since then. Now, I've got no reason to believe that people would have been spreading things at Crystal Palace, but and as I say, people are tested absolutely all the time, so you would like to think not. But the one thing that's sort of not happened is that there's been an outbreak that's then led to another outbreak that's then led to another outbreak. So we have to kind of keep our fingers crossed that that'll be the case this time as well, that Newcastle have been able to sort of shut it down quickly enough and well enough, efficiently enough, so that it's self-contained within their own bubble. But I guess that would be the one concern, that there'll be a time when somebody has it and then it spreads exponentially. Fingers crossed that's not this time.
Well, anyway, enough of that. Let's talk about something a little bit more positive. Newcastle went to Selhurst Park on Friday night and came away with 3 points. Callum Wilson and Joe Linton on the score sheet, and they put Palace to the sword, didn't they, Chris?
Well, I mean... That's
no,
probably,
they didn't, Taylor.
Probably, yeah. slight exaggeration. For 85 minutes, it was pretty dull.
But it was awful, wasn't
it? It was still a million times better than what we've seen in the previous two matches. So that probably says a lot more about those matches than it does Friday night. But
yeah.
I think that Newcastle did look more balanced all around. There was definitely more attacking intent there. It's a shame that a lot of those opportunities fell to Joe Linton. But you know that they his all round game was very good, as I wrote about, and maybe we've seen where you can extract a bit more from him,
yes,
if you've got Callum Wilson alongside him. But in terms of just the balance and the way that Newcastle was set up, that they certainly looked to get forward a bit more. The 4-4-2 is what they went for, which Bruce spoke to some of the senior players last week. They decided that they wanted to have more bodies higher up the pitch, and that would hopefully help them. And against someone like Palace, I think it really worked, because they were pretty slow and pretty poor themselves, and a draw possibly would have been a fair result, but Newcastle managed to nick it in the end, and it really has sort of changed the mood a little bit, and going into this run of fixtures now where they could potentially get a few more points, let's hope, if they can build on that result.
I mean, George, for 80 odd minutes it felt like it had nil-nil written all over it, didn't it?
Yes, I mean, when you said put Palace to the sword, I think Newcastle...
I was being facetious, George.
I know, but they put Palace to the penknife, let's be honest.
That's what they did.
But they saved the best till last. It was weird. I mean, I was watching it, and I have to say, I didn't really feel very much at the end, I have to say. I mean, but obviously very pleased that they won and very happy that they did so. That's what having a centre forward on the pitch can do, and I agree. I got into trouble on Twitter because I was kind of being silly, but Mark Douglas from the Journal and Chronicle, he said something about Joe Linton, I think at kind of half time, and sort of said, you know, his movement and that sort of stuff looks better. And I just replied, 40 million quid. And that brought out some kind of quite strange sort of Joe Linton love. And he was a lot better. I mean, he wasn't a lot better in terms of finishing, but he was a lot better in terms of the other parts of his game. And of course, we're all longing for that solution to be found and to find a way of accommodating him and the team and looking better. And he did look better. I mean, it was also a game that they played without Alan Saint-Maximin, so he's probably somebody we should talk about as well for all the stuff that was that was happening on and off the pitch last week too. But no, I mean, yes, it was a horrible 85 minutes. It really was. It wasn't sort of joyous at all. But they kept going, and they do, you know, they are capable of doing that, and they got a result. So yeah, very, very pleased with that. I can't say it made my heart sore
It was a lovely bit of work by Joe Linton from the throw-in, wasn't it, for the first goal for Callum Wilson. I thought he did fantastically well, bundled his way through like vintage Shola Amiobi. It was beautiful to watch. never really in control of the ball, not sure where it was going, but it ended up in the right place.
I thought it was one of his best all-round performances for Newcastle. Now you can argue that there isn't much to go by before.
The bar's not really high, is it?
The thing with Joe Linton is that I think in one sense we both have to still keep addressing the fact that he cost £40 million, but that's from a Newcastle point of view. Newcastle spent £40 million on him, so they have to try and get some value from him. But Joe Linton as an individual and in terms of what he brings, I think we almost have to try and disconnect the £40 million from him. If you see what I mean, there's almost two strands to this. That can't be forgotten about, that Newcastle have spent all that money. But every time we talk about him and what he brings to the team, because he's never going to be a £40 million footballer. He's never certainly going to be a £40 million striker. So it's what can Newcastle actually get from him? Can they get something out of him where he fits into the team and he actually brings something positive? And I thought on Friday he did. I thought he put himself about a lot. His shooting obviously needs a heck of a lot of work, his shooting intent, because that was it was almost, you wanted roles reversed, because and Callum Wilson to be the one who was on all the end of the chances, because if he had, then Newcastle may have won 3 or 4 nil, because that what he does, he showed when he got through, he scored goals. But I did think that this is, we saw it against Burnley, and then he's back in a similar sort of position, even slightly further ahead, but in that number 10 role, or as a second striker, whatever you want to call it, I do think you do see what he can actually bring to the match when he's got someone alongside him who is expected to score the goals rather than himself.
I sort of agree with that, Chris, except I also don't, because I think the thing is, if he had cost £5 million, then I don't think he would have been anywhere near the team as much as he has done. I mean, the two things are intrinsically linked. You are right to say that they have to find a way to make it work, but that is because he costs so much money and that is a huge investment. They have to find some way of protecting that investment, and they have to find some way of justifying that investment, whether it's him playing and contributing to the team or, you know, two years down the line, a year down the line, trying to get some money back for him. I mean, if it was £5 million, that wouldn't be a problem. I'm not saying that they would jettison him and leave him to rot if he cost £5 million. But, I mean, also, I suppose last season there was sort of no choice because they didn't have alternatives. Mm. But it's very difficult not to think about that money at the same time. It's categorically not his fault. But the startling thing is that it's... You know, so I think someone said to me on Twitter, you know, that's nothing in today's money. And to one degree, that's right, except that it is so much a big deal for Newcastle, that amount of money, and still is. And again, you know, sort of every time he's on the pitch, it's sort of, I find it very difficult to sort of to disassociate that determination they were to bring him into the club when Benitez was manager, the February before he left, and Benitez saying no, and there being this huge sort of battle of wills almost about him, and they were going to sign him no matter what. It didn't matter who the coach was, they were going to sign him. And so I kind of quite find it quite difficult to sort of disassociate those two parts of the conversation. I know you're right, moving forward he has to be sort of taken at face value, but it's a difficult thing to do that.
It's really tricky, isn't it, with that transfer fee? I mean, it's an awful, awful lot of money, and if you're breaking it down and you think Newcastle could have bought two £20 million attacking players who would have given us a lot of addition to the squad, you know, and you spend £40 million on one striker who doesn't score goals, and for an entire season it looks like it was a waste of money. I'm hoping that now we're going to start seeing a little bit more, and maybe he's a little bit of a different Joe Linton. I thought he had a little bit of swagger about him on Friday night, I have to be honest, and I know for a lad who's allegedly short on confidence, some of his touches were good. His hold up play is a little bit sketchy at times. I think for the size of him, he should be holding the ball up a lot better. He should be a bit stronger when he's up against the likes of Scott Dan and people like that. And his shooting, like Chris says, really does need work. But I thought he linked the play fairly well, and I thought he proved a half decent foil for Callum Wilson, who was allowed to get on with the job of getting in the right place and being a striker. And Joe Linton kind of linked the midfield to the attack pretty well, I thought. And I thought, as I agree with Chris, I thought it was his best performance for Newcastle so far. Mind you, his shot, it wasn't going in, was it? It was going right at the keeper until it took the deflection. And then it trickled into the net. But I have to say, I was overjoyed for the lad to get the goal. I think he really needed it.
I think he meant it. I think he meant to do that. Just, you know,
do you think he meant that, Chris? Trick shot.
A guiding post almost, isn't it?
This is what we've waited all summer for.
What makes Newcastle United so special for the fans?
It's tribal. You come out and all you see is black and white.
Unlike Manchester and Liverpool, the city unites behind the club.
It's part of what growing up in the Northeast is about. It's who we are.
And yet this is a club that hasn't won a domestic trophy since 1955.
For years this club has gone with one mistake after another.
When you're a Geordie, you get kicked. You just get up and get on with it.
The Championship has been a graveyard for some huge clubs.
It's simply about promotion to the Premier League. Can they do it?
They kind of have to, really.
With a manager like Rafa, we've got hope.
We haven't had that for a long time.
How are the lads?
So we're going to be back and talking a little bit about Alan St. Maximin and all of the drama that's surrounding him at the moment. But first, we've got a very special guest on the podcast. We're going to be talking to Zara Zomorodian. In her own words, Raj Packett, maker of films, aspiring cult leader. That's a good job I said that right. My God. Aspiring cult leader. And one of the clever brains behind the fantastic fan film, We Are the Geordies. How are you doing, Zara? It's lovely to have you.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. I'm all right, actually, a little bit stressed, but, you know, it's to be expected after you know, what's going on in the world and also trying to release a film in the middle of it all.
Absolutely. I bet that's a really difficult process. How has it all been going with that?
Actually, it's been going really quite well. We've done a film before ourselves called The Stag Do, which we self-released, and it literally was self-released, like handing out flyers outside St. James's Park and stuff. This time we've actually got a little budget and a little team, and what a difference it makes.
Wow, I can imagine. George, you've been involved in this project, haven't you? What's your role in all of this?
Just hanger on and glory hunter, basically. But
something good, basically.
No, I mean, that's a slight exaggeration. I mean, I appear very briefly in the film. It's been a labour of love for Zara. It's 4 years in the making. It's the story of the promotion season under Rafa. Mm. But it's a story that's told really through the kind of first-hand experience of Newcastle fans. It's very beautiful to look at. It's beautiful to listen to. And it's a kind of great reminder. I mean, in some ways, it feels like awful timing for a film to be coming out when people can't go into the cinema. But at the same time, it's also wonderful timing because it reminds us exactly what we're missing without people in the stadium. And I would urge people to download it or buy the physical release. It, I'm sure Zara will give us details about that. But yes, it's just a love letter to Newcastle and to Newcastle's people and to Rafa as well. A very, very special season. But I mean, I know it's been very, very frustrating for you, Zara, over the past few 4 years to kind of get it done. But you must feel chuffed to bits that it's actually here now.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, you've heard my whinges and my whines about the various trials and tribulations of getting the thing done. And you're right, now that it is done, it's actually great. Mainly, well, two things. One, get rid of it. Woo-hoo-hoo, take down the chart off my wall. But also the opportunity to share it with the people that it was made for, which was predominantly Newcastle United supporters. Like George says, it's kind of a love letter to you guys, the people who make Newcastle United what it is.
It turned out, obviously, we know what happened that season and kind of very famously. Why did you choose that moment? I mean, was it because the circumstances of having, you know, this world-class manager who'd agreed to stay on and be part of the club and the championship, was it that it specifically, or was it something that you would have done anyway?
You know what it is? It was a conflagration of circumstances. So I went to London to do a training course on making low-budget films. The kind of general whatever philosophy behind this way of thinking about filmmaking was, instead of spending ages writing a script, then resourcing the script, look at the resources you have around you. And because I was involved with NUFC Fans United and Newcastle United supporters and kind of a little bit obsessed in a weird, non-creepy, stalkery way with Newcastle United supporters and the lengths that they go to support the team, I thought, well, I kind of have a bit of access there. And then through Steve Hasty, got access to the club. Rafa being there obviously sort of makes it all magical. Bernabeu to Barnsley is kind of quite a good story. And obviously, you know, he's a world-class manager and all the rest of it and stayed with us when we went down. It was like a set of circumstances. But as I've said before, it was 2 months to the day between an idea popping in my head, written down on a scrap of paper, NUFC supporters film, to interviewing Rafa Benitez in the training ground the day before the Fulham match and bricking it. And, you know, as much as you're not in the film massively, had you not, George, I'm talking to here, had you not kind of backed us, said it wasn't a really stupid idea, thought that, you know, we weren't completely insane, it probably wouldn't have happened. From me sliding into your DM saying, how do you fancy being a movie star, to you probably only ending up with it in about 5 seconds.
Yeah, you definitely missold that dream. But I'm
still waiting on the limo, aren't you, George?
Yeah, I definitely am.
I think we're all still waiting for the limo.
But I think that's the kind of beautiful part of it. I appear right at the very beginning, and what I'm doing is, I remember being in the stadium kind of vividly this moment. We were talking about really the jeopardy of that season. And yes, Rafa being there, but the club hadn't changed and the ownership was this, you know, hadn't changed. And the championship had been the graveyard, you know, for big clubs. We've seen that. And yeah, there was huge momentum behind the team and the club at the time, but you didn't really know. You didn't know. But you did know that it was going to be a good story. And there are some kind of really big names who appear at the start of the film. But I think the point is that they're not the stars. So when you're talking about the stars of the film, it is the people who watch. I mean, it's full of absolutely kind of beautiful. I mean, it's beautiful to look at. That's the first thing to say. And it does remind you about the sort of stature of the stadium and the size of the stadium and what it looks like when it's full. And obviously it takes you around the country as well. I mean, it was you had to do a lot of those journeys, and tells the story of those people who are sort of passionately following the team. But it's the stars of the film are Newcastle fans, and it's there are a few sort of individuals that it focuses on. So I suppose my question is, what made you choose the people you did, and what were you sort of trying to get across with your choice of Newcastle fans to feature on?
The main thing I wanted to get across was that, unlike how they're portrayed in certain sections of, in particular, the national media, we don't have massive expectations as a fan base, and we're not all fat Geordie blokes with NUFC tattooed on our moobs that we're willing to get out at the drop of a hat.
Speak for yourself.
Well, yes, I am speaking for myself here, Mr. Payne. But it was just to say that, you know, there is a diversity within our support that I think, both in opinion and in, you know, the traditional sense of the word diversity, that quite often gets overlooked by, in particular, the national media. And that's what I wanted to try and capture. But it really was about, you know, as everybody else is seeing now, thanks to the pandemic, the fans really are the most important thing within football. I mean, otherwise it's just 22 blokes, 11 on one team, kicking a ball around. It's the chance, it's the crack, it's the banter. That's what makes it special.
I mean, it's funny you say that. I mean, I was lucky enough to kind of see the film a few times over the past 4 years. And obviously, I've seen it change and things like that. And I've watched it again. I watched the final version. It's very emotional. It's very moving. A lot of those stories are moving in their own right. But it is just that thing, exactly as you say, that this is the thing that we haven't got at the minute. And I've found this a real struggle. I mean, I recognise how lucky I am when I've been to games just to sort of have experienced it. But for me, that experience is kind of nothing. It doesn't mean anything to me anymore, because I can't bounce it off the stuff that I love bouncing it off, which is other people. I can't bounce off other journalists because you're socially distanced. I can't. But far more importantly, there's no way of relating it to, you know, there's no noise, there's no reaction to a great tackle or a great pass or a bad tackle or a goal or anything. And then there's the other side of it. You just don't get the comedy in the crowd. You don't get the anger from the crowd. You don't get the funny comments. You don't get those great big swells of emotion. And it's very difficult to feel anything at all. And I watch this film and I feel it again. And that's why, you know, that's why I would encourage people to watch it. I mean, not only was it, you know, in time, was it a great season when there was still that real sense of sort of hope and longing and yearning at the club, but just that fabulous reminder of how we need other people.
Yeah, it was really important for us to try and capture the match day experience. So although during the film, for those people who haven't seen it yet, there's not loads and loads of actual footage of the game because the cameras are invariably trained upon the crowd. It was really important for us to try and capture the atmosphere of St. James's Park in particular on a match day. I don't live in Newcastle, I live in Gateshead, but I'm probably only about 2 miles away from St. James's Park. And I can still remember when Shearer broke Jackie Milburn's record, being able to hear Shearer, Shearer, Shearer inside my house, which still blows my mind that, you know, it's 2 miles, but a lot of people all shouting the same thing. That noise travels a long, long way. And that was kind of, that energy was something I really wanted to try and capture. And the emotional investment, as well as the, you know, financial sacrifices and all the rest of it that goes into it, the actual emotional investment of following a football team, or any sports team, but a football team in this case, really closely.
Zora, I wanted to pick your brains a little bit as well. I mean, I myself have dipped my toe briefly into making a film and struggled with it massively. And, you know, the whole process is fraught with issues, isn't it? And things grinding to a halt and money disappearing and all that sort of stuff. So there will have been times over the last 4 or 5 years while you've been doing this where things have not looked like they were going to get finished. How have you kind of overcome all that? What was your process behind just pushing on and getting this done?
Can I just say bloody-mindedness? I mean, in some ways, it's a bit of an exaggeration, but in some ways that is part of it. I just don't quit. You can't ever give up on something, because when Rafa left in June last year, was it last year? Yeah, June last year. God, time's just gone. Yeah. June last year, Rafa left. We literally were finishing the sound mix. That day, we were finishing the sound mix. We still had to clear archive, which, as you know, has a massive cost implication. So the film was finished, absolutely. Bar we used 15 seconds of footage here, a minute of footage there, pictures from Getty Images here, there and everywhere, and they all need to be cleared and paid for. And we had an investor from Israel, bizarrely, who was going to pay for the rest of the film, and it should have come out last year. And then Rafa walked, and then the investor walked, which is, you know, not unsurprising. And I think at that point, that was probably the lowest point where we kind of gave up to an extent, but then got busy making a load of comedy sketches for Channel 4, which kind of kept our creativity going. And then when the pandemic hit, on the one hand, it was shit because, you know, no football, being stuck in the house. I've got a disabled kid who really, let me tell you, ear infection plus autism plus puberty plus pandemic is not a mix that anybody ever needs to go through. But what did come out of it positively for us was bounce back loans. So I applied for a bounce back loan, and that gave us the money to finish the film. So,
I mean, it's testament to your sort of, like you say, sheer bloody mindedness to get it done, and your determination to see the project through. I mean, I find it massively admirable. It's fantastic.
Well, Zara is one of these. I'll embarrass Zara now. I mean, not only is she very creative, and not only has she created this beautiful piece of art, but she's also someone who's a unifier, who believes in Newcastle fans getting together and working together and being on this, reminding us that we're on the same side. You know, she's a big Newcastle fan. But so I want to pay tribute. I really want to pay tribute to her, and for producing something which honestly stands the test of time, and something which beautifully captures the club at a really interesting moment. I think we kind of look back in some ways and feel like, well, that was straightforward, wasn't it? Newcastle in the Championship, that was great. We won every week. But of course, it wasn't like that. And there was drama within it. And there was definitely tension within the club at the time. But as I say, it's a sort of sensitive, beautiful examination of what it's like to be a Newcastle fan. And it captures brilliantly that experience of a match day. And it makes me feel very sort of have that sense of sort of longing for us to get back to those days. But I promise you, this is the next best thing.
So Zora, where can people find this? Where can people get your film from?
At the minute, we are doing DVD pre-orders from the website, just because I need to know how many DVDs to manufacture. I don't want to be tripping over boxes for the next 12 years, but at the same time, I don't want to run out the week before Christmas. So the website's wearethegeordies.com, and there's a buy button on there. It'll also be in shops, HMV, hopefully the back page, Windows, etc., etc. And then for people who, you know, not everybody's got a DVD player anymore, I appreciate that. Digital platforms, so Amazon, Virgin, Sky Store, iTunes, Apple, I'm missing something, Google, whatever. We are the Geordies.com is the best place to keep up to date with things. There's like a sign up thing, and I'm not going to spam you. I haven't sent anything out yet. It'll just be as links come online, I can send them to people if they don't want to buy the DVD.
Brilliant. Well, that's Chris's Secret Santa sorted anyway.
Yay.
Are you still there, Chris?
I've already ordered it, so.
Have you? Great.
That's what you're getting. Sorry, mate. Either like it or lump it.
Well, I'll just have several versions.
He will like it. He will like it.
Thank you.
I'm sure he will. I'm sure all Newcastle fans will like it as well. Zara, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us. It's been absolutely brilliant having you. And good luck with the film.
Thank you.
And we'll push it out on Twitter and stuff like that to make sure people know where the links are to buy it and things like that. So good luck with it. Hope it all goes brilliantly for you. And thanks for coming on and talking to us. It's been fantastic.
Fabulous. Thank you very much for having me, guys.
So, Christopher Woff, Mr. Waffles, Sergeant Sausage, how are you? Are you okay now?
I'm fine, thank you. Yes, that was very
good. Excellent.
It was very interesting to hear about all that. I am looking forward to seeing it.
It was wonderful, wasn't it? Fantastic project. Chris, I want to talk to you about the enigma wrapped in a conundrum, surrounded by mystery, shrouded in confusement. That's not even a word.
Confusement.
Confusement. Which is Alan Saint-Maximin. What the devil is going on with him at the moment?
Well, yes, he was a notable absentee on Friday, and that was said to be a calf injury, which he pulled out of training the day before, but there was reports that he was going to be left out the starting lineup anyway, and it does very much sound like that was going to be the case. And you just have to look at his performances over the last few weeks, and really, he hasn't been influencing matches as everyone knows that he can, and there's been a lot of talk. Is that to do with his position? And possibly it was. He was being played in the 5-3-1-1 formation. He was essentially played as a number 10, a position he did actually ask to play in, though. He was keen to play in that position as well, and he really wasn't materially affecting matches. And I think there was just sort of the mood within the sort of club that maybe it was time to sort of take him out of the team, try something else. And so a lot of fans obviously were very angry about this. Why is the Newcastle's, in theory, best player being taken out of the side? And I understand that, but I do think that they've rewarded him with a new contract. And for someone who is now among the best played players at the club, he really needs to be scoring more goals and assisting more. And this is he has been a conundrum throughout his career, and I wrote a big piece on it last week, speaking to people who have worked with him basically throughout his career, teammates and a former coach. And basically, there's a lot of Newcastle fans are saying, "Oh well, if there was a better coach, then he would be getting more out of him." And maybe there is an element of truth to that, but this isn't just happened at Newcastle. It hasn't just happened at Newcastle. Everywhere he's been, there's been these questions over consistency. How do you motivate Saint-Maximin? How do you get him to keep performing? And he's only 23, and I accept he's still young, but this is something where there definitely is an issue there, where Newcastle are going to try and have to manage him correctly and try and extract far more from him.
I mean, George, this isn't the first time something like this has happened, is it, with Alan Saint-Maximin, where there's been a bit of drama surrounding him? If you cast your mind back to that cup game that we went to with West Brom, there was all that chat before the game of him being dropped or, you know, having a bust-up with Steve Bruce. He sounds like a tricky character to manage, but is this just sort of, you know, is this just media building it up to, you know, it's a bust up, it's an argument, it's a fallout, or do you think it's a little bit more cut and dry than that? It's a bit more simple.
I mean, I think all these things are nuanced. I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, the art of management is getting the best out of different people, and everybody is different. Chris, for example, needs an arm around the shoulder. Taylor, you need to kick up the backside. You know, we're all different. We're all different. I'm joking. You probably don't. You probably want an arm around your shoulder as well. But
I'd like an arm around my backside, please.
You like an arm around your backside.
Yes.
And Chris likes
a kick in the shoulder. Yeah.
So that is part of it. That's part management, and it always has been. And yes, it's often sort of said that, you know, with genius comes, comes other parts of character. And so this isn't something that's just that's new. It has happened in his previous postings. And Steve Bruce has said from the start, he's going to take up a lot of my time. He is the one player Newcastle have who is the difference maker, who can do something on his own, who can turn a game. Now, we haven't seen that. We have not seen that for too long. And Chris is right. He was going to be dropped on Friday. And
really, there's a very interesting balance here. I don't want to over-dramatise it because, yes, as you say, Taylor, what happened last season proved that, you know, one man's bust up is another man's sort of what's not a serious bust up argument,
handbags,
you know, whatever, that gets resolved straight away, and yeah, something kind of good can come out of it. And obviously in the media we use dramatic language sometimes to sort of describe stuff that's pretty routine, but it does sort of make me think a little bit about another mercurial Frenchman who played for Newcastle, who was full of talent, but wherever he went seemed to cause disruption. And that did not end very well for Newcastle. And you know who I'm talking about there. I'm talking about Hatem Ben Arfa. And that's not a situation that the club really can afford to get into again, where he was sort of hailed as this Che Guevara rebel figure who sort of came to represent everything that Newcastle could be if they only tried a bit harder, who was being held back by a limited coach and all that kind of stuff. And it was really difficult for Alan Pardew at the time and the club. And, you know, he is going to take delicate handling. But absolutely, as Chris said, it's also St. Maximin's responsibility. He's been given a big contract now. You can argue whether that was a good move on behalf of the club or not. I mean, they're protecting his investment, but they're, you know, they're kind of stuck with it. St. Maximin has to, you know, does have to knuckle down. He has to show that his attitude in training is right. There have been whispers around the club. So it's not one of those easy things where there's one hero, one villain, and it's black and white like that. It's a nuanced situation, but we definitely have not seen what he's capable of in recent weeks. I think partially that's positioning, but he hasn't looked right to me. So hopefully that can get resolved.
He definitely hasn't looked right. And I mean, the last few times I've watched him play, he's looked disinterested. He's looked a little bit lost, and like the game's just kind of passed him by a bit. And it's a totally different answer, Maximin, from the one who appeared after the initial lockdown break and when the Premier League returned in the summer. And he was ready and raring to go and running at defenders and demanding the ball from his teammates and really, really looked like a kind of player where everyone thought, wow, what have we got on our hands here? And then this season, he started fairly well, I think. He did okay. And I remember the game, was it the Burnley game, where he provided the assist for Callum Wilson? And he looked okay, but he's just slowly gone further and further off the boil, hasn't he, Chris?
Yeah, and I mean, actually, since the Bournemouth game, when he provided the three assists and was
Bournemouth, that's
what
it was. Bournemouth,
then
not
since Burnley was this season. Burnley got a goal and assist, but I'm talking about Bournemouth after the restart.
Right,
there
was okay. Well, I was right.
There was about half a dozen games either side the restart when he really did look like
he did, yeah.
If you can play like this consistently, then this really is a player Newcastle have on their hands. But it that's been the problem throughout his career. He goes through these fits and starts where everyone knows the ability he has, and it was interesting that one of the coaches I spoke to, who managed him at Bastia for a little bit, Rui Almeida, basically said, I look at him and think he's at 60% capacity, and he compared him to Diogo Jota, and a lot of people seem to raise their eyebrows and say, well, he's not the same sort of player, but I don't think he meant in terms of stylistically. What he meant was, yeah, Jota has gone up a level and is now scoring a lot of goals. He is making sure that he's getting goals and assists, and he has jumped up, whereas St. Maximin, there's a lot of very nice things he does, and partly it is down to how the team plays, and partly it is down to how he's been used, but there is also that individual responsibility where he has the ability to influence games more. He flits in and out of them, and he needs to make sure that, because he can be the player, if there's going to be one player other than Callum Wilson providing the goals, if there's going to be one player who's going to drag Newcastle to higher than just bog standard mid-table, if they're going to have any chance of sort of breaking in that top 10 and maybe beyond, it needs Alan Saint-Maximin to be playing well.
Well, fingers crossed Alan Saint-Maximin gets back to his best and we can see him firing on all cylinders soon. We're going to wrap things up there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome indeed.
Thank you, yes.
Thank you for your time.
It's been lovely speaking to you. And thank you again to Zara for coming on. And make sure you check out wearethegeordies.com and have a look at that fantastic film that they have made. Look after yourselves, ladies and gents. Remember, theathletic.com/Newcastle Pod. £1 a month for the year. £12 for an entire year of the best football writing that you can find. Make sure you get on there and check that out. Thanks for listening again. We will be back with you very, very soon. Look after yourselves. Goodbye.